Welcome to Workforce RX with Futuro Health, where future-focused leaders in education, workforce development, and healthcare explore new innovations and approaches. I'm your host, Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health. Because of the critical role they play in our lives, healthcare organizations receive a lot of scrutiny from journalists, policymakers, employees, and others. So it's critically important for them to be able to communicate effectively. More than 1,000 healthcare organizations across 45 states have turned to my guest, David Gerard, for expert communications guidance on restructurings and other complex issues. And we're going to tap into that wealth of knowledge today to understand some key elements to communications success. David founded and led a firm which carries his own name, Gerard, which became the nation's leading strategic communications consultancy in healthcare. And I want to note that Futuro Health partnered with his firm on promoting a training program for in-home and community-based caregivers of older adults through CalGROWS, a grant which we received from the California Department of Aging. Thanks so much for joining us today, David.
Oh, thank you for the invitation and for the opportunity to work with you and Futuro Health as well. And I appreciate this time with you.
Absolutely. Well, the mission of Gerard is, as you have explained to me, make healthcare better. You come at this work from the perspective of trust and storytelling. And I was wondering if you could just elaborate for us what that means.
It means we recognize the power of storytelling, which I know is not common parlance in business today. But particularly in healthcare, the stories are powerful and compelling. And so we work with our clients to tap that power to do what they need to get done, which can be to provide care, of course, to their patients and their customers, but also to energize their workforce, right? So they reflect the calling that they have together to serve. Stories are interesting things, we think. They slip around the defenses that we all have through which we filter information and make decisions. But when you tell somebody a story, you're drawn along in the stream in an emotional way, and bringing those emotions to communications makes it sticky, makes it palatable, and makes it something that you want to be part of. So we enjoy working in story to help our clients move forward.
I was wondering, David, does the storytelling change, or how it's told change, given how digital we are nowadays?
It does. It does. The medium can certainly reflect in effect, the message that you tell. A video story is different than a speech that you're going to give. But the need to share from your heart and elements in real life is fundamental to drawing audiences along with you in whatever form, whether it's a series of 15 tweets, one after another, that build to a climax and then a conclusion in a story, or whether you're delivering 15 slides on a PowerPoint before a small group. We work with so many people in healthcare who come to it from a clinical background or a financial background. And so them, stories are like Excel spreadsheets or data reports. And they'll put up slides or they'll tell stories with variances and numbers in it and think that tells the story. And they find that it doesn't work with audience. It doesn't land. But when they say, because of these numbers, we're able to care for this mother better and faster. This child is able to walk or recover better and faster. This family is able to go back to work, right, and generate income and feed themselves. Connecting the data and some of the clinical elements of healthcare to actually the experience, right, that patients have or that employees can have, turns it into a story that is compelling. So we help them make that translation between what they're very comfortable with and what they want to accomplish.
Oh, that's a very good tutorial. So thank you for that. Now, I mentioned that you work with over 1,000 healthcare organizations across 45 states. Can you tell us what you've been hearing about workforce development and their workforce pain points?
Oh my gosh, workforce pain points. Workforce is the pain point for healthcare today. When we ask, you know, leaders of healthcare systems what keeps them up at night, it has been this way for a long way, but particularly since COVID, it is the number one issue. And workforce, of course, is a big umbrella. It covers a lot of things, but it includes recruiting the best talent, finding the best talent, and then retaining the best talent in their organizations. And retaining certainly includes the kind of elements you would think about. The compensation has to be right. The experience has to be right. The workflow, the days that folks can work are right. But it's more than that. There's an experience of working now that is important to every employee, and particularly those folks who are just now onboarding and entering the workforce. One of the things that's changed is the demand is greater than the volume of folks who are there to meet it. And so new nurses and new people entering healthcare have choices. It's a competitive marketplace that didn't exist 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And so being competitive in the experience of working is a challenge, particularly for traditional healthcare systems. So answering that call, answering that need is easily the number one issue facing healthcare systems today.
And so when you have these private conversations with these leaders, are they at the point of taking action, or what are some thematic actions that they're taking, David?
Well, they certainly are. And some are the kind of things you could easily anticipate. What can we do for compensation? How can we change vacation days or PTO or some of the more structural elements of the environment? But they're also hearing the small things that matter in the experience of working in a hospital or health system, for example. And there might be things that, you know, you might easily dismiss if you're not working, you know, at a nurse station every day or on the third floor or the fourth floor. And it's things like, are the supplies that I need easy to get to? Are the towels here? Do I have bathroom breaks that I can take? Are there enough nurses for the patients that I have to serve? Sometimes very fundamental things can make a really significant difference in the experience people have working in an organization. And the leaders we work with, particularly those that are very sensitive to this, are engaging not just in the compensation questions, but in the where are the towels, where are the supplies, where are the masks, and can I have them readily available to me? It makes a difference.
That's interesting because it sounds like the small issues are stacking up.
They are stacking up in a competitive environment when nurses, and when I say nurses, I mean sort of clinical workers writ large, have choices. They can go across the street, not just for a different hourly rate, but for a different work environment. It can make a significant difference. You know, I'll include, for example, parking. If you have to take three shuttles to get to your work, right, because you're in a downtown environment or academic environment or other environment where parking is limited, it can make a significant difference of your experience working there. You have to add, you know, 30 minutes to the end of the beginning of your day to get to work on time and get back home to your car. Where in a different environment, you can drive right up to the front door. It makes a difference in deciding what your, not just your work life is going to be, but what your life is going to be. And we have found, you know, on the other side of the pandemic, and not just in healthcare, but in other industries too, people are approaching work with different filters. I mean, they're measuring it sometimes in different ways. What do I want, not just out of work, but what do I want out of my life? What do I want my daily experience to be? And we find smart healthcare leaders are taking that into account.
It sounds like the temperament of the workforce is less forgiving when it comes to these small issues, right? So, you know, what are some missteps that you see as leaders, as well-intentioned as they may be, when it comes to engaging the workforce writ large?
Well, certainly ignoring some of the issues that we've just discussed. One we find repeatedly is the difference between communicating to your workforce and engaging with them. And traditionally, the work has been top-down communication. Leadership says this, they send a memo that says that, and they think communication has happened. The difference we find today is that the workforce is expecting a level of engagement or dialogue or conversation to take place. And in a conversation or dialogue, leadership initiates a conversation, and then the workforce gets to talk back. They get to share. It doesn't mean everything has to be a coffee conversation, but there's using digital media, you know, working through the management structure, even through the nurses' stations and other avenues. There's ways for ideas to be shared back and forth so that even if the ideas that are shared aren't the ones that are adopted, there was a sense of being heard, a sense of being listened to. That is an accelerator of a sense of engagement. It takes longer if you're leadership It takes more work. You have to be more deliberate about it. You have to build in time for the give and take to occur. But the result is a more rooted, more grounded workforce for your organization. And we have found it to be extremely valuable to retention, sort of long-term commitment of your workforce to your organization.
So when leaders strive to be present, visible, and engage and have these two-way dialogues, what kind of coaching do they normally need so that they have the right balance of presence and engagement? But I'm sure there's a range of feedback that they get too. So how do they balance all that?
And balance is such a good word, because it's not abdicating the need for leadership that any organization has, or the need for leadership that a workforce has, with being heard, right, and being seen, being paid attention to. It's not one or the other. And sometimes leadership teams misunderstand that they're abdicating leadership by, you know, leading an engaged workforce. It's a yin and yang. You've got to be able to bring both. For some schools of thought, you know, you lead a certain way all the time and you never change your tenor or tempo or approach. And in fact, particularly in this sort of very agile workforce that we're in, as a leader, you're listening all the time and you're adjusting what you're doing and how you're doing and how you're leading conversations to the audience or to the moment, which is a lot of work. It's easy to just fire and forget and that this is the way we do it. This is, you know, this is the rhythm of the conversations. This is decisions that we make and the way we make them, because it's the way we've always done it. It can be very safe and very, I don't know, thoughtless in the approach. Today's workforce demands thinking. It demands a kind of engagement from leadership that directs, right, when the time is right for direct, but also listens and builds consensus when it's time for listening and building consensus. It's the ebb and flow that has sped up on the other side of the pandemic that I think is a challenge to leadership today. But you mentioned the word presence, and I want to emphasize that as well. Part of the great value of digital media is how fast and how pervasive it is. And now there's cell phone apps and email for sure, and all the other ways we communicate digitally. It's fast and furious and chaotic and can be very valuable at communicating quickly to a lot of people, really important in healthcare and a bunch of other industries as well. But the cost of that is it can become very impersonal, or you can become very distant from the humanness of leadership or understanding the humanness of a workforce. So in addition to using all the great tools that are there and sort of leaning into the latest and best, we certainly advise leadership to get out of the office, get out of the C-suite, get out of the first floor, the fifth floor, wherever you are, and walk the halls. It's old school stuff. It's rounding, right? It's sitting in the cafeteria and knowing people are there and can come and sit down and talk with you. It's shaking hands with people, that flesh to flesh, the palm to palm. It makes a significant difference. And it's not necessarily an effective tool in communicating a data point. You know, this is now the new mandatory overtime procedures and blah, blah, blah. Plenty of ways to share data. But to build trust and to build credibility, you've got to look somebody in the eye. You've got to shake their hands. You've got to be slow and attentive. You got to have that moment of pause where you can actually hear and be in the presence of another person. It's costly because it takes time, and it means that you're paying attention to that floor or that unit or that group of nurses or employees instead of working that spreadsheet, you know, filling out the forms, getting the machinery working. But the cost is a fundamentally important investment right now. I think people leave work now, leave jobs, because they're looking for that sense of connection in a world that is more and more disconnected. It's a competitive advantage.
And David, when you coach someone to walk the halls, how does it work in a distributed work environment? Or let's say they have a lot of facilities. Is there a way to think through how to prioritize which halls you walk in?
Sure. It's a really good question, because there's certainly in complex organizations, there's a whole hierarchy of leaders. When we say leaders, some people, sometimes you think, well, if you don't have a C-suite name next to your name, then you're not a leader. Not true. And in fact, we find particularly in healthcare, which is our specialty, that the most trusted leaders are both a workforce's peers, their shared peer connections, and the managers that are closest to them. So the nurse manager or the nurse director, for example, if we're talking about nurses. When we're talking about walking around, it's certainly the C-suite should visit occasionally and have those intimate moments and bring pizza to the nurses working the night shift and take ice cream to the ER at the right moment. That can be good if it's not disingenuous, which is another conversation we can have. But it's the mid-levels. It's the managers and nurses who need to slow down and walk the halls. And it's a challenge for mid-levels, by the way, and you know this, nurse managers and directors, because they have been nurses before, and they know how busy their peers are and how busy they are just to get the job done. We need to redefine what that job is so they can have the freedom and the comfort of slowing down so they can make that connection. Sometimes we find the mistake is, particularly at the mid-levels, a great sense of assumption that since I just did this job 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I know what the job is. I know what the pressures are. I know who you are and what you're feeling now. It's not true. It may be somewhat true, but not fully. And the danger of assumption is we can make decisions and send folks in directions that are not helpful to them or the organization. And it can actually be costly. The world is changing and the workforce is changing very rapidly. So to go get that real-time information and data is vitally important, I think, to being able to make the decisions that you want to make.
So it seems like on a weekly basis, I see email feeds that talk about new mergers and acquisitions happening in the healthcare sector as entities partner with each other due to financial needs. I'm sure that is a big challenge in terms of managing all the diverse stakeholders, including patients, employees, and the communities, especially when they have an established brand that is being disrupted by the change in ownership.
Yes.
David, what is happening here? What's your observation?
Well, the healthcare world is consolidating. It's folding together. You know, healthcare, now particularly healthcare delivery, is as big as some healthcare providers are, and they're big. I mean, they're hundreds of millions or billion-dollar organizations. In the scheme of things, in the scheme of healthcare, which is a multi-trillion-dollar industry, I mean, health systems are still mom and pop organizations, right? They're still small compared to, let's say, Optum or a large insurance company, right? They pale in comparison. And so we're finding the industry is continuing its path to consolidate, to come together. It was a trend before the pandemic. The pandemic has accelerated that. And so we see not only more consolidations, but we see bigger consolidation, bigger organizations coming together. And that's going to continue. Here's the mistake we find often in consolidation is the leaders of organizations hold the information about the possible merger or partnership so close that when it's revealed or announced, it's a surprise. It's a shock. As if no nurse or no doctor or no one in the community has seen healthcare coming together or that healthcare is dysfunctional and needs a solution. In a sense, it's almost disrespectful to the very people who deliver care. Our strong advice is if an organization is considering and has begun the path for consolidation, to begin that conversation now with the people who actually deliver the care. You have to make the case for why consolidation or merging or partnering is the right thing to do, why it's needed, because if it's not needed, then why do it? So you have to create a sense of the need. You have to explain your business case, in a sense, and not just in the numbers, right, but in that emotional sense. Here's what we're not able to do if we remain on this course. Here's what we can do if we partner. Here's what we want to do because it's fulfillment of our mission. And then begin to talk about, here are the steps that we're taking. Here's the criteria that we have in place. Here's the only things that we'll accept if we do partner. And then ultimately, here's the partnership and here's what it means for you. And here's what it means for you as an individual member of the workforce. And this is a step we see so many people miss. They'll argue, here's what it means for us as a healthcare system. we'll be able to hit these numbers, we'll be able to open these clinics, we'll be able to sustain like the continual operation of these hospitals or whatever. But there's another step, which is a fundamental step, which is here's what it means for you on this unit, in this floor, in this OR, for these waiting rooms. You got to bring it down to the personal level. Until folks feel some sense of security in their own path, in their own ability, frankly, to feed their family, send their kids to school, it's hard for them to hear any other attributes that are part of the fix of this dysfunction that's in healthcare. So start there. Start where the people who matter most.
So, David, you're laying out a future of care that is consolidated. So let me tie that back to the issue of workforce and human capital development. So those who are listening on this podcast come from the education, the workforce side of the world, as well as people who are in healthcare who care about these issues. So if you are going to intersect this future that is a consolidated future of care, what advice would you have for us, things to think about?
There are several. The opportunities for folks entering healthcare, for new nurses, new clinicians, new staff, are going to be significant and varied. I mean, there may have been a time in the past when the options were pretty clear. I'm going to work in a doctor's office, I'm going to work in a clinic, I'm going to work in a hospital, and the models were pretty well defined. That is evolving. And so the options can range from, you know, working in an outpatient setting in a variety of ways, working in homes and delivering care, and to working in traditional structures. Understanding, having good conversations about the opportunities and challenges of each can be really important as people decide what career path they want to choose. That's thought one. Thought two is, as you and I have just been discussing, this is a very dynamic industry. I would encourage new professionals entering the workforce to be flexible, to be fluid. Some folks know very early on in their lives and career, this is what I want to do, and this is the path I'm going to take forever, and I'll stay on that path until I'm 65, and God bless them. I don't know who those people are, but God bless them. But the world is going to shift. Whatever where you and I are talking about healthcare day, it's going to be different in 24 months, in 48 months. And feeling confident, right, to surf and ride that wave will be very helpful in how you think about your career and what success looks like. Every piece of that education that you're going to have as you enter the workforce is new information that will shape the professional that you're going to become. Having that receptivity to experience as part of your continuing education throughout your career will be invaluable to you. That's less of a course that I could offer for an academic or university that's teaching new clinician today, but it is a mindset that I think is crucially important. Those that have that sort of malleable mind about the future are going to find like great success.
It sounds like the mindset is all about versatility and being able to flex the environment, but also the skill sets or the roles that you go in.
Yes.
As healthcare changes.
Yeah, very much. The versatility is just right, and the willingness to learn. And there's a core element that we find in healthcare, which is what attracts us to it. That is an important element that we feel to everyone in the workforce. And that is the sense of calling or the sense of mission that caregivers bring to it. I don't know if it's unique to healthcare. It may be unique in education too. Teachers feel that calling, and there are other cause-driven professions where people feel that calling. With everything we've described about consolidation and versatility and agility can be very exciting and important because healthcare, I think, is broken and needs to be redefined, and the pieces are laying all over the floor. And so we've got to assemble this new jigsaw puzzle. That's exciting if you're an entrepreneur. It's exciting if you have a versatile, agile mind. It can be chaotic and frightening and exhausting if you don't. If you're expecting stability, this is going to be a challenging work environment for you. So what is the stability in the midst of chaos? It's your calling. It's your mission. Mm. Like remembering why you are and why you answered the call of this profession. What's your deeper mission is fundamentally important, we think, in healthcare today. That's true for the individual, the doctor and the nurse and the tech and the clinician. It's true for organizations too. I don't know of a health system whose mission is to have a big building, you know, to have a big square box. Our mission is to have a, you know, this machine and this many floors. And it's not about the buildings. It's not about the structure. It's not about how we define like the expression of healthcare. It's a healing mission, right? It's a journey to bring like a better way, of being for individuals. And how we do that is changing. And we need caregivers who are answering that call today.
So, David, I was in Arizona recently at a forum that gathered healthcare CEOs and their board of trustees. It was hosted by the Healthcare Management Academy. And the topic of nonprofit or tax-exempt status came up. There's increasing scrutiny on these charity care practices of nonprofit hospitals. I was wondering if you can give us some context on that issue.
Well, you're certainly right. It is an energetic conversation today. This is where not-for-profit health systems, which is most health systems, are being challenged to demonstrate that they are, in fact, earning their tax-exempt status. You don't pay taxes, but in return, ideally, that means you're providing charity care or you're doing something like medical education that improves the delivery of care in your community and takes care of those who can't take care of themselves. And health systems, as we discussed earlier, are big. You know, in many communities, they're the biggest buildings, and there's cranes going up because there's more buildings being built. So it seems like they have a lot of money. What are you doing to earn this tax exempt status? And a lot of folks are being questions about it. I think there's a couple of things at play here. Up close, some of this is just driven by the cost of care. Healthcare is just unbelievably, literally unbelievably expensive. And we've been protected from it for a year by insurance premiums. And so that's kept us from having to consumers absorb the direct cost of care. But as insurance has become more expensive and that cost has shifted to consumers, then the cost of care has become truly like an impactful economic decision that consumers are dealing with. You know, when pollsters ask voters, what are the things that are on your mind? What are the things that are going to drive how you vote? The economy is certainly there, foreign affairs, certainly there. But healthcare, and specifically the cost of care, it's a weighted, heavy and burden that people carry. I mean, you and I probably both know people who've stayed in their jobs only because they've been able to keep their healthcare insurance because they've been afraid to do something else. That fear, which is a palatable and not unreasonable fear, is a challenge that leads to this kind of conversation about the size of healthcare systems and what are you doing with the amount of money that you're getting. And we can have a conversation about whether healthcare systems are actually responsible for the high cost of care, but they are in the center of the spotlight. And if you're a health system, in 99% of the cases, you are doing everything you can to fulfill your mission and care for every soul that comes into your circle. And that means paying nurses enough compensation and hiring enough nurses, enough clinicians, enough doctors, having enough examination rooms to provide that care. And there's a cost to that, and it's not getting cheaper. And we've all seen the labor conversations that have increased the wages of nurses and clinicians and staffs over the last several years, and rightly so. So as healthcare becomes more competitive, the cost of providing that care goes up. Then the cost of care itself goes up. And we go deeper into this broken thing. So that's happening up close. If we pull back a little bit beyond the cost of care, I think there's a greater conversation about the brokenness of the delivery of care. And not just the delivery of care, but healthcare itself. And let's bring pharma and insurance expenses and actually healthcare delivery itself into that conversation. We see it over and over again as media and lawmakers and regulators begin to lean in and look closely about what healthcare actually is versus how we envision it should be. This is the way healthcare should be. It should be delivered like this. Ideally, it should be delivered like that, when in fact it's not. When in fact the rules and regulations require certain things in a variety of both delivery mechanisms, but also a way of accounting for that care, there's a great disconnect and great sense of the brokenness of it. Mm. And please don't ask me, so therefore, what's the solution? I don't have a solution, but I can tell you, just an observer, there's the day-to-day sort of examination of the way the levers and pulleys are working today, there's a bigger question about what are we doing? Can't we just take care of our people? Is there a better way to do this? I think that's the question that's driving so much of this.
I won't ask you that question, but let's end with a not an easy question. So I hear a lot of conversations about health equity and a commitment to health equity. And so in light of all of these trends that you've laid out, you know, what's your advice in terms of identifying when the commitment to health equity is authentic?
It's a very timely question. The word equity itself has gotten caught up in a whole vocabulary challenge, I think, that we've seen recently play out in other venues related to diversity and inclusiveness and, in other words, in this soup of politics. And it's become politicized in a very politicized environment. So it's sometimes hard to have this conversation. What we find is when health systems think about equitable delivery of care, they're often thinking externally about the populations that are underserved in their market. And they're doing their level best to identify those, not just the populations, but the services those populations need and to bring those services to them. There's great sort of effort to make that care, the delivery and access to care, equitable. And then the other element, of course, is as those underrepresented or underserved populations access their system, that they're welcomed into it, that they understand that there's barriers. It may be, how do I pay for care? How do I even, frankly, get to care in a way that I can access it? So it's sometimes it's not the delivery of care, meaning, are there enough machines and enough nurses? Is it, has access of care itself been made equitable so that the people who need it can actually access it?
Well, that's a great way to end. Thank you so much, David, for sharing all of your insights and coaching us on elements of the healthcare industry. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the work you're doing to bring this workforce to the delivery of healthcare. It's so needed today.
I'm Vantone Quinlivan with Futura Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.